Welcome to a special Christmas edition of the weekly podcast from the Church of England. In this week's programme, we hear from British Forces chaplains as they came together at Lambeth Palace in mid-December, and Reverend Canon Caroline Pinchbeck, Director of Communities and Partnerships Framework in Canterbury, talks about her and the Bishop of Dover's recent visit to the refugee camp in Calais. But first, Peter Muniki, the coordinator for the Westminster Churches and Synagogue Winter Night Shelters, speaks on how the project is helping those experiencing homelessness to rediscover friendship. Martha Linden started by asking him how the night shelter worked.
2 years ago, the synagogue joined us. So this is their second year with us. So we have six churches running 6 days a week. And then on the seventh day, Saturday evening, we have a synagogue that provides a shelter too. So the procedure is the guests arrive at seven in the shelters. They receive a lovely warm welcome, tea, coffee. Some places provide nice hot soups, and James Piccadilly is one of those places. And the volunteers will literally welcome the guests in and just make them relaxed, show them where they're going to sleep, sleeping bags, camp bed for some people. The mattresses are all blown up if they're blow-up mattresses, as well as sleeping bags and pillows. And people just relax. There's newspapers around. Often there's games. A lot of our guests are really keen on that. And then at 8 o'clock, the whole shelter is designed around that all the guests sit together with the volunteers and they share a meal together. Over the years, one of the consistent themes and report backs from the guests is what a value it is to sit together and share a meal with people who they know want you to be there. Welcomed you there, and guests often say that because our guests can come from various backgrounds, we always say that people are, you know, we don't say so much homeless people as people experiencing homelessness, and they just really enjoy the company, just the welcome. People from different backgrounds, a lot of people from a lot of our parishioners, and people in the synagogue are from banking world or the legal profession, and it is a real break from the normal conversations that guests have amongst each other around what services to use, when day centres are closed, where to get food. So you're just simply feeling that you're a normal human being. That's one of the report bets I get around certainly eating together. So they'll eat together, and then after that, they all find where they're going to sleep. They bed down, and then they're up around 6:30. They have a breakfast together, and then the guests return to the, certainly if it's Monday to Friday, they'll come back to the day centre, where we're open a drop-in from 9 to 11:30, and then appointments afterwards and groups. This year is the first year where we've had 13 churches and one synagogue, same synagogue. So what we've done this year is we've given all of the churches an opportunity to serve. And this is the process that we've worked with. A new group of churches will begin in February, others will start from March. All of this will happen until the end of May. So from three churches, if you like, 5 years ago, we now have grown to having 13 churches where we have to ensure that each gets a period of time where they could serve our guests.
What kind of atmosphere do you try to create within the shelters?
Well, we try to create an atmosphere where the guests feel that they are guests at someone's dinner party. And that is really repeated as a theme right throughout. You know, we have churches which really value that and emphasize that during the training. But each church has a coordinator, and that coordinator recruits from their parishioners, volunteers. Now I go around to each of the churches, or sometimes I'll do what I call an induction with a group of churches or individuals. But the emphasis is always on recruiting people who are aware of that and aware that they're going to create an atmosphere where they're going to invite people home. And the church becomes the home that we invite vulnerable people. They are anxious, scared. One guy last year, I remember saying to me before he got into the shelter that he used to sleep with, you know, he said, I couldn't really sleep. He said, I had that kind of twilight zone sleep where I almost had one eye open. And he reminded me one particular night that he felt something moist on his fingers once, and he kind of was half asleep and wondering if he was still in his dream. And then when he woke up, it was a fox licking his fingers, and that made him jump. And the first time he got to the night shelter, not only did he experience the warm welcome of, he called strangers who became his friends, as he understood it, but it was the first time he was able to sleep with both eyes closed. And he just found that very valuable.
You've spoken about St. James's Piccadilly and how the guests are housed inside the church.
Yeah, I remember actually when a few years ago, and this is now repeated over the last few years, the guests have said to me, it's awesome to be able to sleep in a church. And there are a couple of people who've never been in a church who say, this is amazing. We actually can sleep in a church. And, you know, they really love that whole idea. And in particular, and again, this has been repeated over the years, and I could say because there was one particular person this year who really emphasized to me, he says, Peter, when I go to St. James, he said, I know where I'm going to position my mat. He said, I position it at the altar. He said, and I look up, I have a massive smile on my face, because before I go to sleep, the last person I see is Christ. And he said, and the first person I see when I open my eyes in the morning is Christ. He said, if you knew how much that warms my heart, he said, I wish I could tell you. He said, if I had an opportunity, I would sleep there 7 days a week.
You also spoke about the other services that are provided by volunteers and congregations, such as St. James's, with their rent deposit.
Yeah, absolutely. We have, I was looking today, it's 5 Anglican churches involved. So St. James Piccadilly, yeah, additionally, had some members of the congregation who they wanted to contribute a bit more. So St. James, 2 years ago, spoke to a group of people, parishioners in the church, and they raised over £3,000, which was amazing. And they donated that to the centre and said that we could use it for rent deposit. And so the plan was to use it for our guests to get a deposit, rent deposit, still apply for the bridging loan. When the guests receive that money into their account, they would pay that back. They didn't have to pay it back all at once. They could decide how to do that. So the pot has remained replenished. I mean, not everybody's been able to pay back. And St. James have had a conversation among those people who were happy to donate that amount of money. And they're looking at replenishing the pot fairly shortly. That has been an enormous help. And we've had probably 8 to 10 guests rehoused through this rent deposit scheme.
Can you explain the role of the West London Mission in this work?
Yes. West London Mission took up the role to appoint a coordinator 2 years ago when Reverend Annie Kirk left the post of coordinating the churches and the synagogue. But the mission had the vision to pay for a coordinator and continue that role and add to it in the sense that I've been able to meet with new guests and then walk with them to the different venues so that they're not lost along the way. We don't just give our guests a map and say, oh, this is the church for tonight. The great opportunity for me as the coordinator is I can meet them outside the day centre and then I'll arrange either we walk there or we go by bus. And that's a great opportunity for me to get to know them and to reassure them that the church or the synagogue that they're going to, you know, they will receive a welcome and, you know, they'll meet the other guests. And it should be a really good experience for them and a supportive experience.
And you can find out more about the work of the Westminster Church's Winter Night Shelter by visiting www.wlm.org.uk. Around 40 British Forces chaplains met at Lambeth Palace last week to discuss their roles. Gillian Moody spoke to a number of them about their work and spending time together.
So I'm the Reverend Wing Commander Ruth Hake. Tell me a little bit about how today has been.
Today's been really, really good. It's been really interesting. We've gathered together, obviously, a group of chaplains from the Royal Air Force, from the Royal Navy and from the Army. And we've had a really good opportunity to speak with the Archbishop and the Bishop and Canon Porter about reconciliation, which is one of the Archbishop's priorities for the renewal of life in the Church of England.
How useful is it for you to all get together like today? Can't happen very often.
It doesn't happen very often, certainly not a group of Anglican chaplains from all three services together. So it's lovely to get together with colleagues and see people you haven't seen for a long time and that sort of social side of it, but also to really get to do some thinking about some of the really big issues that we face as military chaplains and as priests in the Church of England as well.
What do you think is different about, apart from the obvious that you're with the forces, what is different about being a military chaplain to having a parish, for example?
On some ways it's very, very similar. Obviously ministry is ministry, and we're dealing pastorally with people and human beings in all the different issues of life, so it's in a lot of ways very similar, but in some ways it's very particular and very difficult in certain areas in which we minister, especially when we're in a deployed war zone maybe, or away from family and friends for a long period of time. We live that life alongside the people with whom we minister, so we take some of the strains and stresses of a military life and we live them alongside those to whom we minister. So it's a different challenge, obviously with a lot of similarities of normal everyday ministry, I suppose, but also with some very specific differences.
And presumably you're working with people of all faiths and none. How does that work?
Absolutely. We are all souls ministry, so we work with everybody who comes our way. So we don't make any distinctions in terms of faith or in terms of gender or in terms of race or anything along those lines. Anybody who comes to us, we deal with. And actually, we find that by and large, nearly everybody in the military will come and speak to a chaplain at some point.
What do you get out of your ministry?
I absolutely love my job. I wake up nearly every morning delighted that I'm going to work, and it's a real privilege to be able to work with some really amazing people, and also to be able to bring God's love to a lot of people who are going through quite intense experiences, whether that's just separation, whether that's issues with being away from family, whether that's issues of life and death. And that's a really fulfilling ministry to be able to have, and I'm very grateful that it's one that that I can have and can fulfill.
And talking of separation, we've got yep. Christmas coming up, which is obviously a really tough time on forces families.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There's obviously we have chaplains who are deployed at the moment, so we have chaplains who are away from their families. So we, as I say, we live that life. It's an incarnational ministry. We share those burdens, but also we minister both to the families back home and to the service personnel who are deployed. Especially at this time of year, it can be very difficult, especially when you're away from children and away from family and friends and all the normal things that make Christmas a fun time of year, make it quite a poignant time of year when you're away from those people who you love and you want to spend that time with.
Peter Eagles, Deputy Chaplain General to Her Majesty's Land Forces, that is to say to the Army, and Archdeacon for the Army.
How have you found today?
It's been very good. We've had days at Lambeth Palace before with the Archbishop and with Bishop Nigel where they've hosted gatherings of chaplains, and that's important because it emphasises our link, our relationship to Bishop Nigel and to the Archbishop as our ordinary. And I think for him to make a point of showing care for the chaplains and having time in his diary for them is very much appreciated. And then today the theme was on reconciliation, so that's an area in which we have a degree of experience as well. Canon David Porter took as his working example for his part of the presentation some of the background to Northern Ireland, and many chaplains will have familiarity with that context. So I think it's been very productive. And then celebrating the Eucharist, or the Archbishop celebrating the Eucharist for us, the Bishop preaching, and lunch afterwards. So it's been very good, very good indeed.
It must be nice just to get together and have the opportunity to talk to other people.
It is, and with our colleagues from the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, we're three separate chaplaincies, clearly, as we are three separate services, and there are differences in the way that we do things, but obviously what we share is a vocation to chaplaincy within the armed forces. So today we had 20 chaplains from the Army and 10 from the Royal Navy, 10 from the Royal Air Force, and to catch up with them, some of whom are familiar, others less so, and to share experiences. That's also a very valuable part of the day.
Do you think people go away from today feeling valued and that the work that you do is important?
That would be my hope, absolutely so, that people go away thinking they've had contact to the centre of the Church of England and the Anglican Communion. They've had the benefit of the Archbishop's wisdom and experience, also David Porter's wisdom and experience, and that actually in sharing that with us, the Archbishop has shown that he endorses and values our ministry. And I think for us to have the opportunity to feed back to him and to Canon Porter some of our own experiences was very good as well. You know, chaplains do have significant experience in conflict zones, in situations where one is required to manage conflict, sometimes actually quite immediate conflict. So that's an area of real interest for us. So it's been a very good day.
Does it feel different at the moment because of everything that's going on, particularly in the Middle East and with the airstrikes recently? Does it feel like the mood has changed slightly?
Probably. I think all of us would say at the moment that it's an unsettled time. It's an unsettled time for defence. We don't quite know what our commitments are going to be, where the next few months will take us. There's one way, I suppose, in which life is always like that. Defence engagement certainly is very much a part of what the army does now, and chaplains would look to support that. So in that sense, I think today has been a really appropriate topic. And we'll just see where that takes us. But what we would want to do would be, through our own experience in this area, to support the Archbishop clearly as fully as possible, and for him to continue his work in supporting and inspiring chaplains in all that they do.
And presumably in a time of uncertainty, to be able to have a chaplain for people who are in the forces is a really valuable tool.
It is, and I think very few people would dispute that. And certainly the 10 years of conflict in Afghanistan have proved that chaplaincy has a real role to play just in supporting our people, our soldiers deployed and our soldiers and families at home, and in strengthening what we call the moral component, that part of what the army does which just enables us to be a community that works together and has ethical and moral undergirding to what it does. So in that sense, chaplaincy is hugely valued and appreciated.
Finally this week, Reverend Canon Caroline Pinchbeck and the Right Reverend Trevor Wilmot, Bishop of Dover, recently returned from a trip to the refugee camp in Calais in a visit organised with the Roman Catholic Diocese of Arras. Ben Hollabon spoke to Caroline about what they witnessed and plans for their Advent Justice Appeal.
It's 6 weeks ago since I last visited, and I think the real difference, the immediate difference that we saw was things were becoming more permanent. So the shelters, there were more wooden shelters being built. Also that it's becoming territorial, so there were fences even around the church that we'd visited last time. And fortunately it's not been a harsh winter, but it wasn't, the ground was muddy. It was quiet when we went out there, so it was, but there's that sense of resolution that it's becoming a long-term thing, both for the refugees, for the volunteers, and just in the environment of the community as well.
And what will Christmas look like for those living in the jungle?
In some ways it was slightly surreal because there were Christmas trees outside the church. But, obviously there are cultural differences. Even in France, being a predominantly secular society, Christmas wasn't very evident compared to over here in England, which is very noticeable. I think for many it will be another day. However, there are many volunteers who are going to go out because it is Christmas. One of the sights was seeing sort of an empty box for mince pies, and you're just thinking this is not quite where the rest of, well, certainly Britain is. In those celebrations, and I think it will just be another day.
We hear a lot about the refugees, but much less about the volunteers working over there. And how would you say that they are faring?
They're absolutely exhausted and fatigued, and even those who have been long-term involved, their faces are looking very gaunt and harrowed. And I think it's the real struggle about actually where is there any chance or possibility of being able to ameliorate the situation, and trying to find what are the best solutions, if any, to actually being able to help the refugees. So with our colleagues in Secours Catholique, one of the things that they've got is a bike maintenance project. It's an hour and a half from the camp to their day centre, and the refugees that were attending were saying, actually, what we'd really like is a bike maintenance so that we can mend our bikes, and those who have given bikes, they could actually bring them up to spec. And we were saying it's a really good project, because what it has done is that actually the refugees are doing the maintenance and encouraging one another. Because I think for me, you know, you've got to, it's the, trying to get the equivalent of experience. It's almost like a prison. You have, you know, once you've washed and you've fed yourself, you've got the rest of the day to do nothing, really, and to occupy yourself. And how do you do that? Well, you know, mending your bike and being able to have some transport. School Catholic are also doing French lessons as well, computer lessons and things like that. So it's trying to increase people's skill set, languages, but also, more brutally, to spend some time doing something, really, when there's not much else to do.
What do you think the future looks like out there?
Desperate, I think, really. I think the question is always, you know, there's a threat of, would the French authorities clear the camp? As I said, the building structures are becoming more and more permanent. The community is becoming more and more permanent. They've built a school. The buildings, you know, the communal buildings are, there are shops and restaurants and things like that. It is really becoming a town. And nobody quite knows, you know, one can relieve individuals, but still the numbers are high. I mean, it's gone down from a peak of about 8,000, but you're still looking at between 5,000 and 6,000 people being there. And because of the security fences around the camp, you know, that sense of possible liberation and freedom is not there. And so I think for the voluntary organisations that are out there, it's saying, well, actually, how can we little by little enable people to find a proper home and to find a safe place to be?
There's been a real outpouring of compassion from many places, but people aren't always sure what to do. How can they make a difference?
The difficulty is a whole issue, which we've, you know, we're all saying, those of us who have been heavily involved, is the more you delve, the more you get involved, the greater the complexity. And I think for me, it's how do we, the organisations that are involved both here in Kent and in Calais and in France, organisations that have been going 10, 15 years, and it's being able to, I think for the diocese, has been able to be in touch with them to find out what the needs are. And sometimes there are those practical requests for clothing and things like that, but actually there are things that we can do in our own communities. Only over at the weekend, somebody was saying about, you know, being able to have English lessons and things like that, because for those of our refugees who are in our county and for other places across the country, again, it's, you know, how do people fill their time? How do they learn the cultural differences? How do they improve their language? But also on top of that, it's trying to have an understanding of the great complexity of political issues. And I think for us, and the request by our stakeholder organisations within the county and across the channel, has been actually, it's about raising awareness. Because in speaking with individuals and for hearing their story is not unique, and it's repeated so many times. And how do you actively respond to an individual's multiplied need, where they've had threat to life, where they've been, you know, removed from their homeland? How do they find their identity? How do they, you know, the trauma that they've had to deal with are all issues which are not resolved quickly. And that's social and economic investment that really is required. We can't quantify that. And the issue is not going to go away. And we've seen that with the climate change debate. Many of people have forecasted this happening. It's how do we inform people, and how do we learn for ourselves? And I think always with such issues which are overwhelming, it's trying to understand what our place, what small contribution could we make, but also how does our individual contribution add to a greater contribution that can effect change? And I think, you know, for me, the hopeful thing has been with our stakeholder organisations is that people have turned to the church to say, well, actually, you're the people who are the vehicle for bringing organisations together, but also raising awareness, and that you are the trusted partner, which then puts some sort of weight of responsibility on us. But also it's saying that we do have something significant to offer the community, but also into the national debate, but also into the debate across Europe, because of our place within the communities and because of our networks.
And you can find out more about the Advent Justice Appeal by visiting www.canterburydiocese.org. That's all for this week. Our next episode of the weekly podcast will be out on the 8th of January, as we take a short break over the Christmas period. I'm Chris Lamarcon, and on behalf of the Church of England, wish you a very happy Christmas. Thanks for listening.